court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Afternoon. Call our third case for today, 02-2860, In Re Termination of Parental Rights to Alexander V. Stephen V. versus Kelly H. We'll hear first from Attorney Philip Green, who will argue for Kelly H., then Dwayne Jorgensen, 15 minutes for Stephen V., and Douglas Hennen as the guardian ad litem, 15 minutes with a 5-minute rebuttal. Are we ready?
Yeah.
Good. Counsel, you may proceed.
My name is Attorney Philip Brame, and I'm a sole practitioner from Janesville. I represent Kelly H., the mother of the child in question. Kelly H. is seated to my right in the front row. There's two relevant issues that need to be addressed today. I want to start with the summary judgment issue because I think that's probably the more important of the two issues. Obviously, it's an issue of statewide importance. As an initial matter, I want to point out that I represent Kelly H. She is worried about this case. She is not worried about where the law goes beyond this case. And I would argue that any change in the law should be done prospectively with regard to the issue of summary judgment. And the reason for that is apparent. The issue in this case was easily resolved when this case proceeded through the trial court level. When this case went through the trial court, there was a case directly on point. And that case was Elizabeth W. And Elizabeth W. stated unequivocally, there is no summary judgment in termination actions, period. If a parent contests termination, they are entitled to a trial. The Elizabeth W. opinion is not a long opinion, but it is on point, and I would argue it's an unequivocal holding. The rationale for the decision is set forth within the opinion. It cites a United States Supreme Court case and a Wisconsin Supreme Court case in its support. And that case doesn't talk about exceptions to the rule. In this particular case, my client told the court it could not do summary judgment. It cited the Elizabeth W. case, which was on point. And in this case, the trial court ignored that Elizabeth W. case. It essentially told the defense, you're going to have to prove there's a need for a jury or a trial before I'm going to give you one here.
Counsel, and isn't that the difference between this fact situation and Elizabeth W.? Basically, Elizabeth W. was based on an abandonment ground. Here, as I understand the facts, and you can correct me, there was no factual dispute, nothing to dispute, nothing for that was not to be decided by the court. Have I mischaracterized?
I don't think you've mischaracterized what Elizabeth W. stands for. But with regard to that argument, and it is raised by the opposition in their briefs, essentially they argue that Elizabeth W. is much different than this situation. In Elizabeth W., you have abandonment. In this case, you have continuing denial of visitation. The argument is that this ground is much simpler, and therefore summary judgment should not be granted.
But what were the facts that were in dispute? Because as I understand, there were no facts in dispute.
With regard to that issue, I would point out that in the case, my client obviously contested, and she indicated that she wanted to put the petitioner to its proof, and that was never done in this case. And at least with regard to one of the facts that would make up the ground, I don't think the record still has evidence that it was properly proven. And with regard to this issue, or with regard to
what was that fact?
The fact was whether or not there was a certified copy of the order from Brown County which denied her visitation and which contained the appropriate warning. It is my position that had there been a trial, petitioner would have had to come into court and would have had to prove up the three elements of the ground, that there was an order out of this other county, the order contained the warning, and the order was in place for 1 year or more unmodified. And like I'm saying, with regard to the issue of whether the order existed, it had to be proved by competent evidence during trial. There was no trial, but if there had been a trial, the petitioner would have been obligated to submit to the trial court a copy of the certified, a certified copy of the order in order for that order to be admissible. And if that order had not been submitted, it's certainly possible the trial court would have been unable to find that grounds existed to terminate my client's parental rights.
Mr. Brain, what did Judge Vandehei take judicial notice of? As it was my understanding that he took judicial notice of such an order. Was he looking at an order, looking at something in the file?
It's my understanding that he was taking judicial notice of an order that had been attached to Mr. Heenan, the guardian ad litem's motion document. I don't think it was a certified copy. In fact, I'm sure it was not a certified copy, but I think what the trial judge did is to say, you know, I'm going to take judicial notice of this particular document. I'm going to assume that it's that it correctly states the relevant information.
You feel that was error under the circumstances?
The error, as I see it, is the taking away of my client's right to have the trial and to put the petitioner to its burden of proof. And what happened here is basically backwards. Basically, the judge says, I'm going to find there's grounds to terminate. You prove that there's not. And that's not how the procedure should have taken place. And my argument is that because it was not done properly, we don't know for sure whether or not the proof would have been made. And again, that was my client's one opportunity to fight the grounds aspect of the case.
Well, now, opposing counsel in this particular case take the position that Elizabeth W. is really an outdated case, that Chapter 48 has since been amended by the legislature. Four additional grounds for termination of parental rights have been added, grounds that really are not open to any real debate as to material facts. Doesn't that change the situation?
I would argue that it does not, and I, in support of that argument, I would say this. I think for any ground that is alleged in a termination action, it would certainly be possible for the petitioner prior to trial to sit that parent down for a deposition. The petitioner could ask questions regarding each of the relevant elements of proof. And it's certainly possible that a respondent could admit that you know, that basically all the elements could be proven rather easily, but they still want their day in court. In the Elizabeth W. case, the ground was abandonment, and one of the potential issues in the case would be whether or not there was good cause for not having visited or communicated with the child. Even with that particular issue, if summary judgment was allowed in a case, a termination case, I would think that a trial judge could basically wade through what the parent presented for good cause, and the trial judge could say, you know, I've had a chance to look at what you're going to allege is good cause during trial, and that is not good cause as a matter of law.
Well, when your client appeared in front of Judge Vandehei, Did she take the position that there was no order denying visitation, or did she take the position that it had been modified within the year?
She did not do that, but her attorney did come into court and said, Judge, I think that the reasons why my client did not comply with the conditions precedent to getting her visitation back is relevant during this hearing.
But wouldn't that really be relevant on disposition rather than on the fact-finding part of the termination procedure?
I would argue that it was relevant at both stages, and at least at the time that this case went through the system, we had the Frederick H. case. And the Frederick H. case basically said why the parent did not comply with the conditions precedent to getting her visitation back is relevant during the fact-finding hearing. And I would assume that when the Court of Appeals used the language fact-finding hearing, they were talking about the first stage, the grounds stage. Certainly, there are some indications that that case has been modified by the Julie A.B. case. I would hasten to point out that at least when this case proceeded to disposition in April of 2002, Frederick H. was good law. Julie A.B. came out in July of 2002, and certainly there's a suggestion that it modified the Frederick H. case, and there are some indications that it in fact did do so.
My problem is this, counsel. The law shouldn't be foolish. There shouldn't be absurd. And I'm concerned that to require a impaneling of a jury and taking testimony in cases where there are no disputed facts as to grounds is really absurd.
And I certainly can appreciate your position on that. However, I think when you look at the relevant case law, we have case after case in Wisconsin which says that during the fact-finding stage, the parent is entitled to the full complement of procedure, that their right to procedure is paramount. And when you're talking about a right that is as important as the right to basically parent your child, you should be entitled to all procedure. And certainly in some cases, the jury trial may seem to be somewhat perfunctory. On the other hand, there still has to be certain things proved during that hearing, and the petitioner should be put to that proof if the respondent requires that. I would also argue that the cases where a jury trial is in fact necessary in this type of case, where this ground is alleged, probably isn't as often as one would think. I certainly believe that there are parents who would decide, I'm going to have a court trial under these facts. I believe that a court trial would be more appropriate for who I am. You would also have litigants who would look at the situation and say, I can't win during the fact-finding stage. I am going to admit there are grounds to terminate, and then I'm going to contest disposition tooth and nail. Then you have persons like my client who decides, I want my full process. And it's my position that if a litigant wants their full process, they should get it. And again, I don't think it's going to be that many cases in the big picture.
But if you take this outside of termination parental rights and somebody has the right to a jury trial and full process to a jury trial, constitutional right, to a jury trial, that doesn't mean that there's no summary judgment. Because one of the rights to a jury trial is only a right where there is disputed evidence or evidence from which there might be different inferences. But you don't have a right to jury trial if all of the evidentiary matters are before the court. Here in probably documentation would do it, an affidavit. You don't have a right to a jury trial, even though it's a constitutional right in this state.
And
why
to,
are you giving, I'm sorry, what my concluding line is, so why give more than is required for everybody else? Now, I didn't put in criminal cases because you have different issues there.
I understand that. I would argue that if you look at the plain language of the relevant procedure, section 48.31 sub 2, in that particular subsection, it talks about the jury shall make findings of fact, the judge shall make conclusions of law. And I would argue that that is a special chapter 48 procedure which would essentially trump or take out of the equation the chapter 801 to 847 procedure. Summary judgment is appropriate in civil cases, but in termination actions, the plain language of the statute says that the jury gets to make the finding of fact.
The legislature had that in mind?
I believe that the legislature did have that in mind. If they did not have that in mind, I do not know why the legislature would not have simply assumed that juries make the decision unless there's summary judgment.
I explore precisely what the source of the right to a jury trial is. Is it the statute, or is it something more than the statute?
It is a statute. But again, my argument is that if a specific section in Chapter 48 says that the jury makes the finding of fact, I would argue that that takes it away from the other procedure that would apply in Chapter 801 to 847.
There's no constitutional right to a jury trial in termination of parental rights cases.
That is correct. I would agree with that statement.
What is the source of your saying that?
It is my understanding that because the termination procedure was developed after the state constitution, that it's statutory, the right to a jury trial, and therefore it would not be an entitlement. That's my understanding, and I may be wrong on that. But
counsel, I want to look at 48.31, which you just referenced. I don't know if you have that in front of you, or maybe I have it all committed to memory.
I have it fairly committed to memory.
Okay. I was saying that in jest, but good for you. We're here in part because 48.422 says that if the petition is contested, the court shall set a date for a fact-finding hearing. Now, I'm looking at 48.31, sub 1, which defines fact-finding hearing. And a fact-finding hearing means a hearing to determine if the allegations in a petition are proven by clear and convincing evidence. My question is where there is no dispute of evidence, can you definitionally call that a fact-finding hearing? And there is no disputes of fact.
I would argue that you would have to. And again, if a parent is entitled to that procedure, I would take the position that there has to be proof.
Let me just turn my question a bit. A parent is entitled to a procedure for a hearing where facts in dispute are proven by clear and convincing evidence, I would argue under 4831, or I would advance. And that's what a parent is entitled to, a fact-finding hearing where you prove by clear and convincing evidence facts in dispute. Now, I'm inserting facts in dispute. You know, that's not there. But that's what they're entitled to. And if there are no facts in dispute, then they're not entitled to a fact-finding hearing, which by definition is a hearing to determine facts in dispute to see if they're proven by clear and convincing evidence.
I understand what you're saying. And to that I would say, when my client takes the position, I contest grounds, she's basically saying, prove the grounds. And in that sense, she is contesting whether or not they're going to be able to prove each of the elements. And, you know, it is a matter of semantics. But ultimately, I think when she enters the denial and puts them to their proof, she's disputing the facts.
I suppose a follow-up to that argument is, I say in my mind, okay, thus far in the record, there's never been presented what are the, you know, except for your certified copy argument, you know, what facts are in dispute? And your client hasn't raised any facts that are in dispute. I suppose the response to that is your client doesn't have the burden to raise facts in dispute. Rather, the burden, if it's contested, is on the state to prove. Is that what your response is?
That would be a fair recitation of our position, yes.
Isn't there an answer to a petition, so you have to deny or affirm?
Right, and that's what she did at the time.
What did she do? Did she deny all the allegations? All the grounds?
She came in and simply entered a denial to the allegations, just a blanket denial, and essentially put the petitioner to his proof. One of the arguments that is brought by the opposition on this case is harmless error. The suggestion is that harmless error should be used to dispose of the issue in this case. And I would admit that harmless error has been used recently by this court to uphold termination orders. I would take the position that the issues in each of those cases was markedly different than the issue in this case. In the Evelyn C.R. case, you had a parent who fails to show up for a fact-finding hearing. She is defaulted. And during that default hearing, the trial court forgot to establish a factual basis. She then comes to the dispositional hearing and argues that she shouldn't have her parental rights terminated, and then on appeal argues that, hey, this isn't right. Procedurally, you should have done things differently when you entered that default judgment. And I would argue in that case, the parent did not do what was necessary to preserve their rights. And the same would be true with the Stephen H. case. In the Stephen H. case, the parent admitted there was grounds to terminate parental rights and then comes in on appeal and complains that there wasn't a factual basis for his plea. And again, I would take the position that in that case, the parent did very little to preserve his rights. And then we have a case like this, where prior to trial, my client comes in to court and says, you know, you can't do summary judgment, Judge. Here is the Elizabeth W. case. It's directly on point. And the judge's response is, prove that a trial is necessary, prove that a jury is necessary in this case. And as has been stated already, my client did not have the burden of proof. I would argue that the error affected a substantial right of my client. She was denied her right to her day in court. She was denied her right to procedure. And again, this procedure is deemed to be paramount during the fact-finding hearing. And I would argue that if this language from Ammon W. and Evelyn C.R. and Julie A.B. is ignored, basically the language becomes rhetoric. It's meaningless. I think that a slippery slope argument is illustrative in this case. I want to present this as a circumstance. Let's assume for a minute that a trial judge reads a petition to terminate parental rights. This trial judge knows the prosecutor fairly well, and he or she knows that the prosecutor is a straight shooter and pretty much tells things like it is. The trial judge is concerned about the cost of litigation, so the trial judge decides to enter a judgment terminating parental rights at the time of the hearing on petition. Now, of course, the defense would say, hey, wait a minute, that's not right, you can't do that. But what would happen at that point? The same types of arguments would be brought up at that point. The argument would be made, well, parent, you can't show that this would have made any difference if you were given your right to a trial or a dispositional hearing. So as a result, the error is harmless. Let's move on to the next case. I just think that that way of looking at things is wrong when you look at how important this whole case is, this type of case. And I would want to point out that in this case, the trial court was made aware that he could not do summary judgment and did it anyway. I'll stop at this point.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Jorgensen, you have 15 minutes representing Stephen V.
Thank you. May it please the court. Dwayne Jorgensen appearing on behalf of Stephen V. I would agree with Attorney Breen that I think the primary issue of statewide importance that we have before us today is whether or not summary judgment is available in termination of parental rights cases. But I think also important, particularly in light of Mr. Breen's closing comments, is that what we're really talking about here is something that's really a partial summary judgment procedure. Because we have, because the TPR process is a bifurcated proceeding, what we're talking about is the first step in the process, and that is whether or not there are grounds that exist to move ahead on the termination proceeding. And the notion that a person is being denied their day in court simply isn't the case. We have the primary focus in these kinds of proceedings where it's very evident that no material issues of fact exist is primarily going to focus at the dispositional stage.
Suppose the ground of termination here was abandonment.
It's very hard for me to conceive that summary judgment.
Everybody agreed on all the facts. I mean, they agreed that this happened on day one, that happened in month three, et cetera. All the facts are just totally agreed on. Maybe that's hard to imagine, but let's assume that. And there's no disputed material facts. There's only a conclusion of law. Maybe you'd argue it's not a conclusion of law. But anyhow, summary judgment?
I think if there are no material issues of fact, I think, yes, summary judgment. In saying that, it's given the fact-sensitive nature of abandonment and some of the other grounds, it's difficult to perceive a fact scenario where there would be that kind of agreement. Because many times what you have in abandonment, and I've tried those cases, is you have an acknowledgement that there hasn't been contact for the required period of time, but the issue really turns on whether or not there's a good reason for it or a good cause.
Let me give you a hypothetical situation, not the facts of this case, but a hypothetical situation. Mother is a drug addict, and she and the two kids, children's father, have never married. She's a drug addict, and during her periods of use, she's abusive to the young children. An order is entered like the order here, which precludes visitation. That's what's referred to, I guess, as a paper, you know, paper basis, paper grounds. And it's unquestionable that that order has been in effect for more than 1 year. The reality of the lives of these two people are, however, this. You know, this is the kind of case you could easily see in children's court. The reality is, even though that court order exists, oh, mom hasn't been using too much. Dad has to make a living. There's the two young kids. So for the first 3 months, they follow the court order. But after that, dad calls mom, and mom really babysits every single day. You know, if you're working in this area of the law, you know that although that sounds far-fetched, it isn't. So, yeah, you smile. So, how do you deal with that fact situation where the evidence might demonstrate that the mother has been caring daily for the child, has been the daycare provider while the dad is working, and yet the grounds on paper exist?
Well, I think you've probably hit upon one of the few fact scenarios that can be conceived of where there would be a material issue of fact in dispute, because I think that ultimately that really puts that puts the substance of the court's order that it really had any real effect on the lives of these people, that really puts that in dispute.
Let me tell you where I'm going on this, and it's this. As I understand the law, that if there grounds are found, if there's, let's say, no dispute of the grounds, whether it's the jury finds the grounds or there's no factual dispute, if there are the grounds are found, then the court under 48.424 sub 4, the court, and it reads as follows, has to find that the parent is unfit. And that reads, if grounds for the termination of parental rights are found by the court or jury, the court shall find the parent unfit. Now, this is where the problem is. A finding of unfitness shall not preclude a dismissal of the petition under 48.427 sub 2. So, in other words, no dispute of fact as to grounds. The court shall say the parent is unfit, but under 48.427 sub 2, the court may dismiss that petition at that time, even though the facts as to the grounds are uncontroverted, if it finds that the evidence does not warrant the termination of parental rights. So by following your argument that if there is no dispute for grounds, you can get a directed verdict or you can get, you know, summary judgment. Doesn't that preclude then the court from saying, okay, there are grounds, no doubt about it. I shall declare the parent unfit. But nevertheless, given the testimony presented at the hearing, I find the evidence does not warrant termination of parental rights. You're kind of reading out the reality that even if there's no dispute, they don't have to terminate because the evidence doesn't support that. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think I think this Court has responded to that situation in last year in its decision in Julie A.B., where it wasn't precisely the same kind of fact scenario that you've
Julie A.B., Sheboygan County, is that
yes,
the,
okay. That, right. Okay. And that was a situation where one of the issues was whether or not
there was a third step, a third
prong. Yeah, there was a third step.
Egregious conduct.
Right. And what this Court basically said in its decision is that those that that is an issue. The prognosis for the parent's improvement, I believe, is fairly close to the language that was used, is something that's appropriate for the dispositional phase of the hearing. And that's in terms of my comment about this really being partial summary judgment, that's where it goes to, is we're not talking about the whole ball of wax here. We're only talking about the specific statutory elements at the fact-finding stage. We've got a whole other process. We've got the dispositional phase and the best interest, what's commonly referred to as the best interest phase, where the interest of the child is paramount. I am reasonably certain that if that were the case scenario that you just laid out, would come through loud and clear that that child had an ongoing relationship with that parent that was seeing it on a regular basis. And I can't imagine how it would be in the best interest of that child to terminate parental rights.
Indeed, it is that I think the trial court made reference to, well, it might be relevant, but it's on the second prong, that
right.
is the best interest. When I say prong, I mean the second step of the hearing. And that response of yours is not unexpected, because that's the way the trial court interprets the law. But then what do you do with the statute that I just read that said in a fact-finding hearing, 48.424 sub 4, which was cited, of course, in the Sheboygan County case, and that said, in citing it, the court shall find unfit. But what do you do to the cross-reference in 48.424 sub 4 that says even if the court finds unfit, the court at that stage, and I'm reading words into the statute, but that's the way I interpret it, the court may dismiss the petition if it finds the evidence does not warrant the termination of parental rights, and that's being referred to in the fact-finding hearing section. So it seems to tie in. Maybe my interpretation is incorrect. Maybe that applies to the dispositional hearing, because sub 2, 48.427 sub 2, does deal with disposition, but it's incorporated by reference, I think, into the fact-finding stage also.
And I have that same reading. And I do believe that if the court, certainly in a case where a summary judgment were brought under your fact scenario, the first thing that I would assume, if I were representing the parent, defending the parent in that case, the first thing that I would bring forward was, you know, look, this, you know, there may be this order out there, but these folks have, as in many cases, they don't have the resources to go back into court and modify the order, and their practice is something entirely different. And you bring that fact forward, and I think you put, by doing that, I think you put a material issue at fact. And so you have a situation where the court can sit back and say, we don't have a situation where we have no material issues of fact and dispute. We need to go forward with fact-finding and do a fact-finding and find out, put everybody under oath, and make a factual determination as to what has been happening here. And I think that's wholly appropriate. But there are going to be the situations, as in this case, where you do not have material issues of fact and dispute. There, and this notion that the, you know, I'm still searching for what the material issue of fact is in this case. I think the judge, Fandahay, was searching for that. And he asked, tell me. And essentially he was ignored. I asked the question at post-judgment, and it hasn't been answered. I asked it in my Court of Appeals brief. It hasn't been answered. I asked it in my brief to this court.
But it seems as though, even though there is no material issue of fact as to the grounds for terminating, that under the statutes I read, the trial judge can still take evidence and decide to dismiss the petition at the end of the fact-finding hearing and not go to disposition, even though there's no dispute as to the facts establishing the grounds. You dispute that?
I think that's probably within the court's prerogative to do that. I mean, and judges, typically when you try these cases, judges are really bend over backwards to give everybody their day in court and make sure that they get every shred of evidence that they can because they're making such an important decision. And I think that's what, in this case, I think that's what Judge VandeHei was saying. Tell me. Give me something. Something that would indicate that there's a reason, that there's some kind of factual dispute here, something to be decided by a jury. I mean, I think the reality is, in this case, is if the jury was impaneled, it wouldn't have anything to do. It wouldn't have anything to decide. And, I mean, to me, that's problematic. We're taking people off of the street and taking up their time, taking up precious court time to resolve disputes that don't exist. And when you balance that against some of the other considerations, one of the things that was not done in Elizabeth W. and Philip W. was there was no constitutional analysis done. There was no balancing test. There was no Matthew v. Eldridge test. There was no balancing about as to accuracy, the risk of error, and the state's interest in having summary judgment. And clearly, when you do that, there is no, in this case, when you do that balancing, there is no risk of error because there is no material issue of fact. There is no danger that you're going to have an inaccurate result because there is no material issue of fact. But what we do have is state interest in proceeding with these cases speedily, expeditiously, conserving judicial resources. We had some 1,300 TPRs filed in the state of Wisconsin alone last year. That's going to take up a significant amount of time on the part of our courts. And I don't think that they should be burdened with disputes, impaneling juries, and spending all the time and effort to do that to in effect, do nothing. And I think in those particular cases, and they may be few and far between, but in those particular cases, I think it's wholly appropriate that we follow the Civil Procedure Code, because our position is there isn't anything in Chapter 48 that tells us what to do when there is no material issue of fact. It tells us that, well, you're entitled to a jury trial, but there's nothing that tells us what to do if we have no material issues of fact in dispute, like we do here. And then you fall back on the Civil Procedure Code. And I think it withstands constitutional challenge. I see that my time is fleeting. Speaking about precious, simply in conclusion, I will stop because my red light is on. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the Court.
Heenan.
My name is Douglas Heenan. I am guardian litem for Alex V. I think where I'll start, again, trying to balance everything that's been discussed already and taking into consideration the Supreme Court's questions so far, the way I look at this is what rights are harmed by the parent who's being dragged through the TPR process by having summary judgment? What is the net effect of all this? That was really my focus when I was going through this at the time and in analyzing this, and I think Justice Bradley's questions are good ones because that's what I got mired down in when I was doing this. What about the fact that the court, even after a jury trial, can take a look at this and dismiss the petition? Now, again, there's a lot of confusion for me on that issue until I read Julie A.B. when that came down. And I just reread the case this morning. Justice Prosser, I believe, authored that decision. And I thought he made it real clear that the state of the law is that if there's a finding of grounds by the jury, or the fact finder, the court must find the parent unfit. Then we move into the dispositional or the best interest phase, and at that time, then the court determines whether or not it's in the best interest of this child or these children to terminate. So that's my position on that issue.
Indeed, he did it. Page 185 say exactly that, but I don't think, and you know, I can be wrong in this, that there was any reference to this, because there need not have been reference to the sub 2. The court may dismiss even after a finding. I'm talking about sub 2 of 48.427. The court may dismiss even after a finding of unfitness if the evidence warrants it. That's okay.
Thank you, Justice Bradley. And I think it's a good point. And again, looking at 48.424 sub 4 in the 2003 Children's Code book, if grounds for the termination of parental rights are found by the court or jury, the court shall find the parent unfit. Then the statute tells us that a finding of unfitness shall not preclude a dismissal of a petition under 48.427 sub 2, which is the dispositional phase. I think another important point in all this is, how does the Supreme Court's decisions as it relates to directed verdicts affect all of this? And to me, that I think is important, at least in resolving this in my mind. The two processes are different. They're used at different times. I know you know that. But the result is really the same. For summary judgment, the standard is that if you have the pleadings and the depositions, answers to interrogatories, admissions, things of that nature, together with any of the affidavits, if those things show that there is no material issue, genuine issue of fact, material fact, that the moving party is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. That's what we're looking at there. As to directed verdicts, basically, the standard there is, well, let's talk about the timing first. The timing is only after there's been a trial convened, but basically directed verdicts only can be used if no reasonable juror could reach but a different conclusion. So at least, again, squaring all this in my mind as far as what makes sense, and I think that's really what we're talking about in relation to the application of the law. And again, you folks came out firing questions as to this issue right at the beginning, is what really makes sense as it relates to the application of the law right now? Well, I think what makes sense is how is it really any different? If you present the evidence properly, it's presented, it's in front of the court during a jury trial or even a trial to the court, essentially you can ask the court to direct a verdict if there's no dispute and there's no reasonable differing as to the application of the facts to the jury instruction. Again, the end result is the same. If you follow Mr. Brame's argument, at least what I think his argument seems to be, is if your client doesn't have a jury trial or a trial at all, that they've been denied due process, that their rights have been violated. But if you're asking the court to issue a directed verdict, you're taking that away from the jury, so it seems to me then that would also be a denial of the parent's due process, because the finder of fact, in that case a jury, if that's what was requested, never made the decision. The judge did, through a directed verdict. So to me, that's where it makes sense. Now, the application of the law part of it, again, and this goes to Justice Bradley's questions, and I struggled with the issue, is how does Julie A.B. affect all this? Well, I need to talk about Frederick H. in order to, I guess, to properly apply the law. Frederick H., I think Mr. Brame indicated that it was down when the decision was made. I may be incorrect, folks, but I think it came down 2 weeks after disposition was finalized in our case. So I don't think it was out quite yet when Judge VandeHei decided the matter before this court right now. But in any event, what is Frederick H. tell us? It tells us that essentially, well, the grounds there were the same grounds that are asserted here, and that any time the parent disputes the ground, that the reasons for not complying with the order should be an issue at fact-finding. Well, again, we know that Julie A.B. takes care of that. The Supreme Court, you folks in Julie A.B. looked at the language in BLJ, which is what Frederick H. relied upon in coming to a conclusion. You withdrew the language. Again, this is it's so interconnected. So my position would be that given the fact that Julie A.B. withdrew the language in BLJ, alphabet soup here, and overruled Kelly S., I believe it is, and Frederick H. relied on the language in BLJ, that the holding in Frederick H. can't stand any longer, at least as it relates to the ground we're talking about in the application of the law. So that's my position as to that.
Do any of these cases really decide this case? I mean, I know you can pull out language from this case and that A case and B case and F case. Do any of them really decide this issue?
They don't. And that excellent point, and it's been the point of discussion between Mr. Jorgensen and I for quite some time. That's the importance of why we're here today, really, is at least for me as guardian ad litem, for this child, I'm looking exactly for what you folks do, policymaking and lawmaking. I think that's what's important, but in sifting through what that is, again, we have to discuss the law and the nature of the law and where it is right now. And I think that weighs heavily in favor of allowing summary judgment procedure to be used in TPR proceedings.
Well, you know, we don't, now that I got the slate clean of all these alphabet cases, it still raises the question that we don't write on a clean slate. We obviously have the statutes. That is the slate on which we write. And how do you get around all this language about fact-finding, hearings, evidence? Maybe your position is that bring in a jury and give them a directed verdict and let's be done with it. It's expensive, time-consuming.
In some ways, Chief Justice, I wonder if that's what we shouldn't have done. But we're here. And again,
but there's also the future.
And there's also the future. My answer to that question is simply this. Exactly right. You have to look at the statutes. Do the statutes allow or disallow the use of summary judgment procedure? Well, we know they don't specifically – well, strike that. Let's talk about disallowing. They don't specifically disallow the use of summary judgment procedure. Implicitly, they allow it because we use 801 to 847 of the Civil Code. You folks know that. It's only through common law that we're not allowed to use summary judgment procedure. Mr. Brehm fully explained that. Now, getting back to the second, at least what I think is the second part of your question, what about the language? Again, Justice Bradley talked about this. I think these are excellent questions, and we have to deal with it. Fact-finding hearing, 48.31, paragraph 1. In this section, fact-finding hearing means a hearing to determine if the allegations in a petition under, and then it lists two sections, 4813 or 48.133, or a petition to terminate parental rights are proved by clear and convincing evidence. Well, it says fact-finding hearing, and again, we struggle with the language. Does that really mean a convention of a jury in order to hear the facts, or does that mean the use of a summary judgment procedure? I think the key is that we need to determine whether the allegations are true.
Is there any legislative history that will help us?
Not that I've researched, Chief Justice.
You haven't researched it, or in your research you haven't found?
In my research, I haven't found any that would be applicable. So I think what's important here is just the simple fact that we need to determine if the allegations within the petition are true, and I think summary judgment procedure can be used to do that and should be used to do that, and I think it would be an efficient use of the process. That's all I have.
Here's my problem. On the one hand, and it's within the statutes and within the constitutional doctrines applicable here. On the one hand, termination of parental rights should not be easy. Dealing with a constitutional right of parenthood. And one that we as a society recognize as very important and should be preserved, and termination is an ultimate, final act. On the other hand, you want our children protected. And so my question to you, I suppose you'll take position that will support your position in this case. My question to you is, why and how should we balance that in such a case where facts are undisputed and as a matter of law they're going to support the grounds? I mean, I'm just assuming that's correct. How do you make that balance here?
Chief Justice, I think where the balance is created is unique to TPR cases in Wisconsin, and that's the bifurcated nature of the proceeding. Again, it's the grounds phase only that we're talking about. The court, we have to trust our courts. We have to trust them to listen to the evidence at the dispositional phase and then determine whether or not termination is in the best interest of the child. That's my answer, and I think that's the only real good way to answer the question.
You protect the parents sufficiently with a summary judgment. That's the ultimate, your ultimate bottom line.
As long as you use a clear and convincing standard, correct. And I think we have to entrust our judiciary at the trial court level to make those decisions.
Could I clarify? 48.415, grounds for involuntary termination of parental rights. Is it your position that if a judge is acting intelligently on the basis of the facts before him or her, he is entitled to enter a summary judgment on any or all of those grounds?
If I understand your question, Justice Prosser, the answer would be yes, but I think the reality of the application would be very limited. And again, there could be even partial summary judgment as to a ground, meaning maybe one or two. I think you're going to see people trying to be creative if you come down with the ruling that it's allowed, that they'll try and do that. But I think the realistic application of what's being argued today is for what I believe Justice Bradley referred to as the paper grounds. That's what we're talking about. So each of the elements under the ground, I think, could be a subset of the ground. I think that's possible.
Well, aren't there hundreds, perhaps even thousands, of petitions for termination of parental rights related to all of these things? And isn't there just tremendous pressure to resort to summary judgment?
I think, was that the end of the question, Justice? Okay. Yeah, I think there are some prosecutors and some corp counsels who would like to use it as to all those, but I think that's where we have to entrust the process to the judiciary. Again, we can use regular civil procedure. Let's take a personal injury situation or any type of contract situation. You folks have been here a long time. I'm sure you've seen creative or attempted creative uses of the procedure there. But I think, in my opinion, the way our trial court judges are going to handle this is it's not going to be easy. They're not going to just let these things through if summary judgment procedure is used. I think they're going to use a lot of discretion. I think they're going to use a lot of they're going to hold the standard, clear and convincing standard, to a high level.
Chief, if I may. Counsel, we've been looking at 48.422. Sub 2, which is if the petition is contested, the court shall set a date for a fact-finding hearing. And looking at sub 3, if the petition is not contested, the court shall hear testimony in support of the allegations in the petition, and then including testimony as required by sub 7. Certainly an argument can be made is, look, sub 2 means shall have a fact-finding hearing. and if it's contested. And even if you don't contest it, the legislature has required that the court shall hear testimony in support of the allegations. So, and looking at sub 3, even if you're not contesting it, the legislature envisions hearing testimony. And then in sub 7, sets out what that testimony has to be comprised of, even in uncontested. You know, have any threats or promises been made to you? Is there any example of coercion and a number of other things? So if they even demand it, the legislature demands it in uncontested hearings and scripts part of what has to be asked at that hearing, boy, don't you think they meant it when they said in contested hearings you should have it?
Another excellent point. As it relates to an uncontested hearing, I think the major difference would be, again, the fact that someone's agreeing to it. And I think that what the legislature intended, and in my experience, what our trial court judges do is make real sure that these people know what they're doing.
But that sounds counterintuitive. If you agree to it, you must have a hearing. However, if you contest it, you don't have to have a hearing.
And again, I think the difference is as to the bifurcated nature of the contested proceeding. And we're only talking about grounds. You know, legislature has focused on have the grounds or the elements of the ground, have they been met? That's what we're talking about at the phase one. And again, it would only be used at that point in time.
Is summary judgment ever granted without a hearing? Under the General Civil Procedure Code in a garden variety civil case?
In my experience, Justice Sykes, it hasn't been.
What about the rules? What do they say?
The rules as it relates to
summary judgment.
I don't recall whether I think there should be a hearing required.
You know, if I read the rules, you have to have a hearing.
Well,
but that doesn't set up an incompatibility with the requirements for a hearing in TPR cases.
Oh, I see what you're quite exactly. Yeah, I don't think we have a problem that way. If there wasn't a hearing required, there should be, and there is, as you stated, under the section, so we're still complying with 48.31 in that there is a hearing.
Right. We're just talking about what kind of hearing.
What kind of a hearing?
A testimonial
correct.
Hearing with the jury?
And whether the affidavits and the motions and the pleadings and everything on file is contested, whether there's a material, genuine issue of material fact.
So what is, if you had a hearing on a summary judgment, would be in essence argument, wouldn't it, by counsel?
The reality is I think it would be. Ideally, what you'd like to see is if, for instance, I filed my affidavit, that there be a counter-affidavit or counter-filings, then you argue like you would in any other civil case. I think ideally that's the procedure that we would envision.
Counsel, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Heenan talked a little about the net effect in this case. He essentially said, what difference did it make? Well, in this particular case, it made a difference to my client. She walked out of the court process feeling like she was treated unfairly. So, as a result, she appeals. So, we have a post-conviction hearing, or post-judgment hearing is the proper term. We have to have a transcript prepared. We argue the case in the Court of Appeals. The case comes here. In that sense, the cost associated with the case has increased markedly, and it's an argument in favor of following the proper procedure. With regard to what should be done in the future, that is what the court should probably be focusing on. I don't think the court should apply what the trial court did in this case based on what the law should be. The law was very clear to the trial judge at the time this case went through the system, and he did not follow the rules. And I'm not saying that he did that out of vindictiveness or something along those lines, but he basically was handed the Elizabeth W. case and he ignored it. And I think a decision regarding this issue should endeavor to try to dissuade trial courts from using inappropriate shortcuts in the future. And that should be done for obvious policy reasons. Mr. Heenan talked a little bit about directed verdicts and how they're similar to summary judgment. There has been no Wisconsin case which has upheld a total directed verdict in the context of a termination action. There has never been a case where the case was ultimately taken away from the jury prior to the jury making its decision. With regard to the language about the court having the discretion to dismiss a petition after hearing grounds, that would indicate to me that there's at least some discretion vested in the trial judge, and it would also suggest to me that the grounds phase is not as perfunctory or clinical as is suggested by the three elements that make up the ground. With regard to summary judgment procedure, I would point out in this case that the trial judge essentially held his own trial and concluded that a directed verdict was appropriate. He did not give the parties an opportunity to present evidence during this trial that he held. The Court of Appeals correctly concluded that that procedure was akin to summary judgment. I do not believe that what the trial judge did was summary judgment either, as the term is described in Section 802.08. The trial judge in this case basically told my client, what is the issue of fact? That's certainly true, but the real issue in the case was, can the petitioner prove grounds during the fact-finding hearing? I think it is looking at things backwards to assume that grounds are proven and then force the respondent to try to show otherwise. With regard to the Matthews versus Eldridge discussion, Mr. Jorgensen touched on that very briefly. I would argue that that analysis would not apply in this particular situation. In the Matthews versus Eldridge case, the issue was whether an existing statutory scheme was constitutional. In this particular case, we had an existing scheme. The existing scheme said that you can't do summary judgment, and ultimately the issue is whether or not there was a misapplication of procedure as it relates to my client. But I would argue that even if you were to take the Matthews versus Eldridge analysis and apply it to this case, that it would come down in favor of my client. First of all, you have a private interest that is very important. We're talking about parental rights. Nobody can suggest otherwise. With regard to the procedure that was used, the focus is on the risk of error. It is not on necessarily the outcome and whether it is reliable. And I would argue that in this case, the trial judge committed error in two respects by not following appropriate procedure. I see my light has came on, and I will stop at this time.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Green, Jorgensen, and Heenan, for your presentations on a very important case, not only for your clients, but as you both point out, for this whole field of termination of parental rights. That concludes our hearing on Case 3, and we are in recess until our third day of oral argument later in October. Thank you.
Nice job.
Yeah, but then they force the Court of Appeals to finalize within 30 days. Isn't that a bit simple? It is. It's bizarre.
Huh? Yeah, good luck. I'll see you tomorrow.